From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Coming up today, Jeffrey Katzenberg's mobile video startup Quibi will feature new viewing technology, but will that be enough to lure subscribers? And film director Victoria Mahoney talks about bringing indie film values to the big budget set of Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker.
I could be in Brooklyn shooting right now on a film for $2.50, and it doesn't matter if the sun is in the sky. I was begging the same way I was in New York with the shop, and it didn't matter how many tools we had, how many toys, or how much big the budget was.
It's The Frame. We'll be right back. The video streaming startup Quibi made its public debut at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this week. Executives Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman announced that their mobile-only service will launch on April 6th. It'll have a $5 a month price tag with ads and $8 a month without. The Hollywood Reporter's Natalie Jarvie was there at CES yesterday for a first look at the new content platform.
Quibi's first real coming out for the public. They've been doing some private demos within Hollywood, but this is the first time they've talked publicly to potential subscribers about what this product is. So they went through all the things you would expect, the launch date, the price point. But the most interesting thing they showed off was this new technology that they've developed called Turnstile that will essentially allow someone to watch a show in either vertical or horizontal format, depending on which way they want to turn their phone.
It sounds like what that's going to require is that filmmakers who are creating content for Quibi are going to have two different edits of the content.
Yeah, so what they wanted to avoid was, you know, if you turn your phone horizontal or vertical, it kind of messes up the aspect ratio of one image. So instead, what they've asked filmmakers to do is to essentially shoot and edit two separate versions of their show, one all in horizontal, one all in vertical, and then they stitch those together so that no matter which way you're turning your phone, you're seeing the image that the filmmaker wants you to see.
Well, the bigger question is, what will people actually be watching? Quibi stands, I think, for quick bites. These are stories that are told in, what, 10-minute installments? Do we have a better sense of what the content is going to look like? Because Quibi has definitely made some deals with some big names.
There's three different tiers of Quibi programming. At the kind of most basic level, they have something called Daily Essentials, and those will be kind of news-driven shows about all sorts of things, everything from entertainment to music to weather. There will be a daily meditation show, different things like that. And the idea is that will kind of get people into the app on a regular basis. Then the kind of next tier up are kind of episodic shows, unscripted. There's one called Chrissy's Court, where Chrissy Teigen will litigate different issues, disputes that people are having. The kind of fun, very TV-esque type show. And then the kind of cream of the crop is really movies that have been cut into 10-minute increments or designed to be told in 10-minute increments. There's projects from Guillermo del Toro and Steven Spielberg and Antoine Fuqua and Catherine Hardwick and a lot of, well-known filmmakers that will be coming in the next year or so.
What you're describing sounds like maybe an iteration of YouTube or Instagram and maybe an iteration of Netflix or Disney Plus or another streaming service. Who do Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman say they are competing against?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, they really are, in a way, competing against anything you could do on your phone. And I think that they acknowledge that to some extent. They don't necessarily see just a Netflix or just a Disney Plus as a competitor, because at the end of the day, what they're asking for is for people to spend that 10 minutes that they're waiting in line or on the bus or whatever it happens to be watching a Quibi show, which means that they're asking someone to watch a show at another time when they might be checking their email or scrolling through Instagram or watching a YouTube video or listening to a podcast. So, they really, at the end of the day, are competing with any app that's on your phone.
We're talking with Natalie Jarvie at The Hollywood Reporter about the news out of CES about Quibi. One of the things that I think is fair to say that no matter how good the technology, if you can rotate your phone and it goes to a different aspect ratio, it doesn't really matter if the content isn't any good. Jeffrey Katzenberg has been around Hollywood for a long time. He's had some hits. He's had some misses. How is Quibi going to do if the content isn't attractive? What is our argument about why people are going to subscribe to Quibi?
That is a great question, because there have been a few different efforts over the years to create Netflix-style apps for short-form video. We had Go 90 a few years ago, and that did not prove very successful. People certainly want to watch short-form video, but they want to do it on a free service like a YouTube or maybe on an Instagram. And they're going to be asking people to pay money to subscribe to Quibi. And so there are a lot of unknowns about, whether or not people find value in that short-form programming and are willing to, pay a monthly subscription fee to have access to it.
Did they say anything about how many subscribers they want to sign up, what their model toward profitability might look like?
They did not disclose any of those numbers, but they are going to have a mix of subscribers and also advertising. So I do think that they see value in having that kind of dual revenue stream and growing, and that should theoretically, if it proves successful, help them get to profitability faster than a service that just requires advertising dollars or just relies on, subscriber fees.
So Jeffrey Katzenberg, been around Hollywood a long time. Meg Whitman, certainly a successful businesswoman. They've raised a lot of money. What are the obstacles for their success?
I think it's challenging to get anyone to sign up for a new service, especially a service that doesn't come with any library programming. So there's no Friends, there's no The Office. There's none of those big franchises that some of these other new streaming services are relying on. So they will really have to win or lose by the quality of their programming. And, it would be helpful if they can have a big hit. But it's hard to have a big hit in these day and age with, peak TV.
Natalie Jarvie is the digital media editor at The Hollywood Reporter. She joined us from Las Vegas, where she is covering the Consumer Electronics Show. Natalie, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, John.
And before we move on, just a note to mark the passing of writer and actor Buck Henry. He had Oscar nominations for adapting the screenplay for The Graduate and co-directing Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty. Buck Henry, a master of deadpan humor, died at the age of 89. Coming up on The Frame, for Victoria Mahoney, it was a long road to directing the second unit for Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. It took the Star Wars movie franchise roughly 40 years to put a woman or a person of color behind the camera. Those dubious streaks ended when Victoria Mahoney was selected to be the second unit director for Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker alongside J.J. Abrams. As second unit director, Mahoney was responsible for action and stunt sequences, along with some of the film's more dramatic moments. We talked about directing a Star Wars film with a strong woman lead like Rey, played by Daisy Ridley.
People keep telling me they know me. No one does.
And Mahoney also talked about working with Lucasfilm president Kathleen Kennedy.
What was exciting for me, my first time I ever said the word action on a Star Wars film was with Daisy. And one of the things about Kathleen, of course, is that we all know she has survived. Can you imagine what she survived and what she's endured and what she's seen? And I know for myself the amount of disrespect that occurs when I walk onto a job in different ways that's just, subconscious bias. People don't even know they have it. You point out they don't even realize they're talking to you with a tone that they would never speak to a man, and the second guessing and all the stuff. And even though my history is like since 1991, standing on sets, a lot of times there's a person who will regard me as if it's my first time and I have a visitor pass, and they don't know they're doing it. So Kathleen and I have a great sense of humor about just all kinds of things. And I dig and respect her greatly.
This is a job, even within the incredibly uneven playing field that is Hollywood, men are probably 99% of the second unit directors. Maybe it's even higher than that. There are certain categories of jobs where you just don't see women working.
Mm-mm.
So how does that happen? and how does it change?
So there are two components to that question. One, the first one is it happens because there's an extreme comfort and I will say probably laziness to the proactivity and how people pursue hires. So it's people just reach over to their left or right side and whoever lives next door to them or plays with their kids at their school, or it's something that people haven't taken much vigor in. It's like a list comes and they just take off, you know, it's like that guy, this guy, this guy, the other guy. The answer to the second part of your question is better suited to the studio chiefs and the producers and the executives, who I'm not sure if they're getting that question and I'm not sure if they have an answer, because most of the time when we present information to them, it's as if it's the first time they ever heard it. I kid you not. You could look at someone's face and realize, oh my God, we never hired, there are no women in second year directing. It's brand new information to them. And I'm excited to be one of the names in many big discussions right now for things that are coming forward. But, you know, and pilots, I should say, the big budget pilots, especially regarding action, there's a lot of work to be done in network television and streaming and cable.
And you have said that to step out of those hiring practices, in this case, wasn't the studio. It was J.J. Abrams who said, let's think differently, that it requires somebody to make that decision and to make that push. And that seems to be where part of the real problem is, that there are not enough J.J.'s saying that. And there are too many people who need somebody like J.J. to say, we need to do it differently.
When I talked to J.J. about his insight in making this decision, he was really clear that the position he has in town allows him certain choices. And who would he be if he didn't make such a choice? And Katie McGrath, who runs Bad Robot, has a very, very clear sense of that.
This is his wife as well.
His wife and everything that they do within the company. But, you know, she's a badass, came through Washington, was a force in her own way. And the movement that she does quietly throughout the industry is very impactful. And what's tricky about all of this is, even though JJ made that decision and his peer group heard it, hear it, the scariest thing to me is the default setting went back. Like, how many movies were made after JJ hired me? That thing that Ava tweeted went around, you know, it was noisy. It went all kinds of people like, hey, wow, he hired this woman. And since then, there's no news on any other top tier franchise film that hired someone similar to me. Not at all.
You said Ava in a tweet. We should say that's Ava DuVernay. Her company Array is a very important part of your story. How did you meet Ava? And how does what she's doing for a lot of people reflect on how leadership works in Hollywood and how you might become that person, you know, a couple years from now?
Well, Ava and I met on the film festival route. We were, there's no good or bad on it, but we were invisible. We were not regarded equal to our peers. And, you know, the story, of course, a lot of people know when Ava won Best Director at Sundance, most people come off that mountain with that title and are offered. They get at least a phone call from a studio, but they're usually offered some crazy, you know, prestigious film, or at least invited to come in and speak about it. So what's tricky is Ava did not get that call afterwards. And it was 2 years, I think, before she was anywhere near a film discussion.
Maybe because she's a Black woman?
Perhaps, just slightly.
Just throwing that
something
out.
To do with mammary glands and melanin. But she, what's interesting is, so when we were going along, we would go out, we're on festival route, and it was really brutal. We never saw reflections of ourselves. So I was in agony, and so was she, and we didn't know that. Every time she got into a film festival, she would say, do you know Victoria Mahoney? Every time I got in, I would say, do you know Ava DuVernay? Because I just wanted to see someone on the route that wasn't the obvious usual suspects. But we had never met. And I think it was a year or so before we actually sat in a room together. And then in the stretch, a long stretch of time where no one would meet me, no one would rep me, no one would talk to me, same for her, we formed an incredible alliance of well-being, and we took great care of each other mentally, spiritually, creatively. We cracked jokes and kept our sense of humor. And what's tricky is one day in the middle of trying to just get jobs, Ava had sent me a note that said, I'm doing this show, Queen Sugar, and you know what? Screw them all. Let's just keep hiring each other. And she asked me if I'd come direct an episode. And that was a turning point. That was a catalyst in a severe way.
We're talking with Victoria Mahoney. She is the second unit director on Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. I'm going to play a clip from your first film as a director and writer. It's from 2011. The movie's called Yelling to the Sky.
I ain't racing for something my parents bought me in the first place. something my parents bought me in the first place.
Bitch, please.
Why don't you go on with your dang bike?
We could be Hilo and Little Man on our slowest day.
Yeah. On your mark?
The time you let Betty go home.
You get a 60-second.
Set.
Just keep on running all the way home.
Go.
This is the opening scene of the movie, and I love that line, just keep on running all the way home. These are women who are not going to be intimidated. They're not going to be cowed. They're going to do what they think they can do, and they're going to show everybody up.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like that's almost the story of this film as well.
And the story of my life. It's great to hear that clip, I have to tell you. And just that day when we went to shoot that, and we had, you know, the film, we made it 18 days, $2.50 and a Band-Aid, and we only had two takes maximum. There was no way to get around making that film with more. So that meant, you know, it was for real Cassavetes style, which people don't honor now. When you go back and watch Cassavetes' work, there are shots out of focus, whatever, and they're just as powerful and just as beautiful and just as strong. But we kind of lived by that. It was like, what we got in the bin is what we got. And the cloud, we were losing light in the sky, and we were under a canopy of trees because we needed it for the different skin tones. And then, you know, we're racing, and to get that shot and what it meant for the crew to unify. And one of the things I loved about making that film was every single person was there because of the film and wanted to be there. No one was there because they didn't get the other job. And everyone had the right spirit. And it was just, I love that film. It tested my mettle, and I found out who I was as a storyteller.
How do you preserve that feeling that you're just describing? You have to shoot in 18 days. You only get two takes with Star Wars, where 18 days doesn't, like, days don't even exist. It's weeks, months. It's like, how many hundreds of takes? How many visual effects can we add? That the math is not even calculable, the difference. How do you make sure that you as an artist, as a filmmaker, are working the same way, even if the scale is grossly different?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because there was a stretch of time that we were in Jordan. I was there 5 weeks, second unit crew, and JJ was there 3 weeks. And in the middle of that, you know, we were all challenged in the perfect way that you can imagine, 100 plus degrees, sand, 35 millimeter. You know, it was crazy. It was so beautiful and amazing, and you can't imagine everything that went into calibrating the efficiency of this. But there was a stretch of a couple of days, let's say 72 hours, where we got our asses beat, for real, like properly getting your ass beat, where you just, it's not, you cannot get yourself in line. The crew, the weather, it's all about Mother Nature. At one point, you know, I was really pissed, and I went, and JJ and I would tap in every morning and every night. So he'd be on one side and I'd be on another side of the desert. And I went to him and I was like, you know, he said, how'd it go? And I was like, we got our asses beat. I was like, it wasn't good. It really wasn't good. And he said, what did you learn? And I said, I learned that Mother Nature is a great leveler. I could be in Brooklyn shooting right now on a film for $2.50, and it doesn't matter if the f-ing sun is in the sky. I was begging the same way I was in New York with the shot, where you have to have that shot that minute, that second. And it didn't matter how many tools we had, how many toys, or how much big the budget was. We couldn't come back to Jordan. So the restrictions, believe it or not, still exist. And still for me, because I, you know, there's a boot in my neck, I wasn't shooting 30 takes of anything ever. And so I didn't want that going back to anybody back in California.
That you were still going to be that incredibly efficient indie filmmaker who's like, tell me what I have and I'll get it done.
That's it. Time and dollar. And I keep to that. I mean, you know, all the pilots I've done, the TV shows I've done, it's just like, how much money do you have? And we're not going a dime over, a day over, and an hour over. And that's something I hold in true regard. But that came from all my indie shit. And that I spent my own money for countless short films in my house, but I paid with my own money. So I cared for that money and how we spent it in the same way that I went to work on Star Wars. Like, I wasn't going to be the one that, I didn't want a phone call from JJ or Kathy or Bob Iger or anybody else saying, what the f*** are you doing? And why?
Coming up, more with director Victoria Mahoney. She tells me about the sacrifices that she made to start her filmmaking career. Let's return to our conversation with Victoria Mahoney. She was the second unit director for Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. And she's got a lot more in the pipeline, including the first TV adaptation of work by the late sci-fi novelist Octavia Butler. Before Mahoney made history as the first woman and person of color to have directing duties on a Star Wars movie, she was a struggling indie filmmaker. And before that, she was an actress. Mahoney talks about the personal sacrifices to move from acting to making her first feature film.
I went back to waiting tables, and I hadn't done that for years, and I was waiting tables, and people who I had done fancy jobs with would come in and see me. And I'm telling you that I held my chin up and looked them straight in the eye, and had no shame in my game. I was just like, I didn't give a fuck. I knew what I was doing, and every nickel and every dime that I made from cocktail waitressing went into short films again, as I said, that I made in my house, because I knew that I needed to work in order to learn and grow, and people wouldn't hire me, so I thought, I'll hire myself. I'll make in my own house in my own way, but I had to be behind the camera. So I, you know, over time, I lived in the red. I shadowed for years. You don't get money for shadowing. You go to work for 5 weeks on a job.
Which is basically an unpaid internship. You're just showing up and just trying to learn by watching.
And mostly someone's therapist, because they spent so much time with these guys, would just complain. Like, complain to me. I would look at them like I was taking 3 buses to get there by 5 a.m. in the dark and who knows where in California. And they would complain about how horrible something, whatever. So funny. Then I had directors, always, so many directors tried to talk, men, guys tried to talk me out of directing TV. Can you imagine right now my whole career, my well-being, my health insurance, everything has come from that I was open to making television, and television has been kinder. If you note, you know, Hollywood has not been quick to hire me as a first unit director since then till now. It's 10 years, 2009 to now, 10 years.
Do you think being a second unit director on Star Wars will change that?
I know it has, because I already know the stuff that I'm in discussions about. Yes. And the minute JJ made, that's what hit the point was. He watermarked me, jumped me into the gang. That was exactly the point.
That's a great phrase, watermarked you, because it is somebody else who has to say this person is legit rather than that person's work.
Yeah.
And that's sad.
It is heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, because think of, first, for me, if we didn't have this shape-shifting in the landscape, if Ava didn't have that moment where she was able to bring me into TV and I didn't have this footage because I assembled something, JJ asked me to send him 2 things and I went in the night and made these clips. We sat and put all the stuff together with action and explosions, things I'd done that people weren't regarding, even though it was there. You could go watch it. Still, it was like, we're going to get a girl to do action. So I had done that and he watched my film. But if he didn't have that amount of work to reference, I would have been in trouble. So TV ended up being a place where film is still not studios, as you said. Big budget franchise films and studios is way behind the curve.
We're talking with Victoria Mahoney. She's the second unit director on Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. I want to ask you about the stories that you want to tell. There are a couple projects you're working on. One of them is the Misha Green, Jordan Peele upcoming HBO series Lovecraft Country. H.P. Lovecraft has his own history with racism, and I'm curious, what about Lovecraft Country and what they can say about where we are and where we need to get to?
Well, Misha Green did this amazing thing that every aspect of what you just pointed out, she flipped it, and it's so bang on. It was an alarmingly exciting job for me to step into. There were things that I got to play with on that job that people have not done in any realm with Black folks, so just full stop. And the actors that I got to work with, Misha's scripts, her words, the production design, the, you know, this guy called John Paul Jones, Black man, and I've known for 30 years and since we were kids, and he did some magical stuff on it. But what we got to play with when it hits the audience is you will be amazed. And it has this bittersweetness that most of what I do does, is that it's so exciting that it's a first, and it's heartbreaking because you think it's 2019.
I want to ask you about another writer with whom you're working, and that is Octavia Butler, who is a great science fiction writer. She's also an African-American woman. That is called Dawn, coming from producer Ava DuVernay and Charles King. What about Octavia Butler and what she represents?
Well, she represents the world to me, because that trilogy of books, it was called Xenogenesis series when it first came out. Now it's called Lilith's Brood. We're calling it Dawn. And when I read that book, I was deeply impacted because I didn't feel reflected in the world. And a lot of what she, you know, so subversive. It's about slavery, colonialism, and sexuality and coexistence. And it's done in this really lovely, light way that you read it and then it hits you afterwards. So I took the 3 books and put them into a series. And I should tell you that the first time we went out to pitch it, the buyers were very homogenized and we did not get any traction and no one knew what to do. And they looked at Ava and I, they were just, there was no way they were going to give Ava, myself, and Charles $100 million to make a TV series. It was just, it was not even, I mean, it was like polite courtesy that they met us and ticked the box. I'm telling you. And then, you know, I went and did Star Wars Mind My Business. Ava was doing When They See Us. And then we came back and we went on another pitch round. And all the places we went, musical chairs, different people, at from the CEOs. And we had a great experience. It was a bidding war. And we'll make announcements soon. But it's extremely exciting. And everything that I saw when I was a young person and read that book, that's what's in the show. And it's really fun. And it's a love letter to Octavia and what she meant to me and to many, many, many kids like me. Still does.
So if there's a young black girl who goes to see Star Wars and you're sitting next to her and you're leaning over during the movie, what are you going to say? What scene? I shot that. I did that. What would you point out?
Well, I probably wouldn't say that in a way that it's the same as any DP would never say. That's my frame, you know, because I'm so old school. But what I would say probably is, you can do that. That's what I would say. Yes, you can.
Victoria, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
That was writer and director Victoria Mahoney. She was the second unit director for Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. And that'll do it for today. We have more to share with you, but you have to sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.